Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we've got a pretty exciting episode for us tonight. We've got a lot of things that have happened this week that we're going to be talking about. And we'll also kind of touch base with Joe on finding out. I don't think there's anything major going on COVID-wise this week, but if there is, we'll get it from Joe. And we've got weather updates and a lot of other things going on. But none of that, and I mean literally none of it, can happen because if Sam's not here, the show just does not happen. Hey, Sam.
And you know I pay him extra to say that. Well, we couldn't do without anybody that's on this show, including Dr. Joe, who's here. And not only our Becky DePodwin, but Dan DePodwin. We coerced the other half into being on, so we'll have a little fun with that tonight because we are going to talk weather. So how you doing, Joe?
I am good, Sam and Jamie. Good to talk to you guys. Everything's nice and quiet in my world at the moment.
Good deal. That's a nice thing to hear. So, hi, Becky.
Hey, Sam. How are you doing?
Good. Your mic sounds awesome. And you have Mr. Dan there. I want to pick his brain a bit. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Great to be on.
So you guys just had an anniversary. I got to ask how you got together. Of course, it had a lot to do with weather, I'm sure.
Oh, my gosh. I don't know if we have time for this story.
Give us a Cliff Notes version.
Yeah, so long story short, AccuWeather has a couple of different offices. I started in the Kansas office. Dan was working in the State College, Pennsylvania office. We met basically through Twitter, knowing that we worked for the same company but in different offices, and chatted when we worked kind of overnights and bonded over like music and things.
And then the first date, so to speak, was about 3 days long, and we decided, because this in retrospect sounds like a terrible idea, but we decided to have it at my parents' house. And Becky flew to New Jersey, and we stayed with my parents for 3 or 4 nights and went into New York City and did a whole bunch of things. And after that, figured we'd give it a shot, and here we are today. So
six and a half years later.
Yeah.
And I have to say, that is like the setting for at least 6 different rom-coms I can think of.
Yes, absolutely.
Probably. But yeah, we've always bonded over, you know, both being meteorologists and love of weather. So it's good to know we understand each other's nerdiness.
But that's a little weird, Dan, at your parents' house.
So the thinking, a quick side note, the thinking of that was that we could have stayed at a hotel, or we could have stayed at my parents' house. And we decided on the parents' house route because a hotel, if you're in the same bedroom and it doesn't work out after the first night, it's really awkward. But if it doesn't work out at your parents' house, it's also really awkward. So I'm not sure in retrospect it was any better. But
his parents are really cool, so it worked out.
Well, I think you're right, Jamie. That's a serious rom-com scenario there. But on to more serious things, we'll start with you, Becky, and Dan, jump in whenever you want to. We got a lot of hurricane activity now, and what's the general weather look like?
Hot and humid if you're in the east. Jamie, did you get storms down there today?
Yeah, it's been raining pretty much off and on all day here in central and eastern Maryland. So, yeah.
Yeah, we had a few rumbly showers here today. I wouldn't call them thunderstorms, but definitely some heavier downpours, some thunder, really kind of oppressive humidity. Tomorrow's going to be much of the same. And then it cools down again. But really kind of across the rest of the country, the Northwest is actually going to experience some severe weather on Saturday. So kind of just hot and humid and stormy across much of the U.S. And then, of course, we had Tropical Storm Bertha on Wednesday.
Yesterday. It was a fairly – it's not easy to keep track of, I think, what happened to Bertha because it wasn't there, then it was there, and then it was gone.
Yeah, I mean, it happened really fast, right, Dan? I mean, it just spun up out of nowhere, it seems like.
Yeah, there was a disturbance that we and the Hurricane Center had been tracking off the Florida coast for a couple days, and it really got its act together yesterday morning on Wednesday morning. And right before it made landfall in South Carolina, it became a tropical storm, was a tropical storm for a total of 5.5 hours, and brought some gusty downpours to the Carolinas and into the Ohio Valley, and now is gone. So it really wasn't much of an event, but it did nonetheless become the second named storm of the season.
Yes, Bertha showed herself. She certainly did. Dan, what's the hurricane forecast? We've been hearing a little bit from Kyle about it. It's supposed to be a pretty active season. Is that what you're perceiving?
Yeah, I mean, you know, from AccuWeather standpoint and from most of what I've seen from a variety of different forecasts, it's an active season is definitely what's on the table here. I know we're predicting 14 to 20 named storms, which is well above the normal of 10. And there could be several, 4 to 6 or so major hurricanes. The normal is about 2 to 3. So a significantly active season is expected. As we always say, and I'm sure it's been said on this podcast before, it only takes one storm, though, to make a difference in a season. It can be the least active season on record, and if that one storm goes in the wrong spot, it doesn't matter. So the key is just to be prepared. But there certainly seems to be a higher chance than normal this year for impacts to parts of the United States from storms as we head into the later part of the season.
Keep your bag packed, Dr. Joe.
Definitely.
You know you'll be going.
Oh, yeah.
Dan, I got to ask you too, that Bexy said you actually manage a forecast team of about 60 people. That has to be crazy during a major storm or the perspective of a major storm. What's that like?
Yeah, it's been it's certainly an interesting challenge. It's one I really enjoyed. I've been an AccuWeather for a number of years, both in the forecasting department and outside of it. So I've sort of seen both sides of the company, and now I'm back managing the team, and it's certainly hectic. And in these days, it's a little strange because most of our team right now is working remotely, which is something we have never done before. But due to the current pandemic, most of our forecasters are working from home, which adds a whole different layer of challenge with communication and collaboration and such. So that's been a challenge too. But it's a really exciting thing to be a part of. And during a major storm, I mean, it's sort of nonstop. And I think one of the interesting things is we found that it's become, especially during tropical season, the storms seem to last longer because we know when they're forming and we know where they're going with more certainty these days. So we can start talking about potential impacts farther out in time. But that makes it even sort of longer and provide sort of more fatigue for forecasters who are tracking these things for days and days on end. And when you can start predicting impacts 5 to 7 days in advance, sometimes that means you're really sort of in storm mode with a lot of stress for a week or so at a time, which can be really challenging.
Well, are your meteorologists split up in terms of area that they observe? Is that how that works?
So it's done in a variety of ways. We have some meteorologists who are focused on certain regions of the country. We have some that are experts in other parts of the world who are focused solely on Europe or Asia. And then we have some part of our operation is structured on sort of our products. Like we serve certain business clients, we serve the public, we serve television stations or radio stations. So it's a combination of regional expertise and focusing on the different products that we issue depending on who's getting the forecast.
And you serve me because I have the app on my phone. So there.
Excellent.
Jamie, you had a question.
Yeah, you were talking a little bit about how we have a little more heads up and a little more forecasting knowledge on where we think the storm's going to be going. Can you talk a little bit about how the models have kind of grown and adapted to become more predictive over the last few years?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the track of tropical cyclones is far more predictive. And I don't know the stats off the top of my head, but the track error based off the different models that are available is far lower today than it was, let's say, at the turn of the century. And it's hundreds of miles or so more accurate on like a day 5 or a day 7 forecast. So if you look at the cone, like the National Hurricane Center puts out, that shows sort of the uncertainty of where a storm could go. If you look at what the cone looked like in 2005 and you look at what the cone is today, it's much narrower today because there's much more confidence in where the storm is going. And that's due to a whole bunch of different advances in modeling and computer programming and the observations we have. The real challenge we still face is the intensity of the storm and predicting that. And there's been maybe a slight increase in skill, depending who you ask. But overall, the intensity forecasts have not really done much in terms of increase in accuracy over the last 20 years. And lots of debate about why that is. But that's the real sort of the nut that hasn't been cracked yet when it comes to tropical cyclone forecasting is the intensity of them.
Well, just for drill, explain the difference between a hurricane and a cyclone, because some people may be confused out there about that.
Yeah, so it really depends on what part of the world you're in. Tropical cyclone is sort of like an all-encompassing term. It accounts for any type of tropical spinning low-pressure system. And then hurricanes are in the Atlantic or the Eastern Pacific. You have typhoons in the Western Pacific that hit Taiwan or Hong Kong or Korea. And then I always forget the ones that are by Australia. I think those are cyclones as well. And I think the ones that hit India and Bangladesh are also tropical cyclones. So all the same atmospheric phenomenon, just different names depending where you are in the world.
Do I remember correctly that they spin in opposite directions?
Yes, they do. If you're in the southern hemisphere, they go the other way.
Huh. Interesting. Well, what I really wanted to talk about tonight, which Dr. Joe can have a big piece of, is, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it, Joe, but the brand new FEMA document, because we've talked about it with other people. It's like, okay, so what happens in the usual scenario with hurricanes? People have to be evacuated. They have to have shelters to go to. And oh, gee whiz, how is that going to work in a COVID environment? It's like, oh, yeah. So FEMA put out a rather impressive document just the other day on how that's all going to happen. And there were some things in there that kind of surprised me that I hadn't even thought about. One thing, Joe, for you, Sar, is I guess they're looking at, and they, you know, be clear on the fact that Joe works for FEMA because he's USAR. I work for Health and Human Services because I'm DMAT. So this really only pertains to FEMA teams. But one thing they're looking at, Joe, is breaking out smaller Type 3 teams as assets. Can you explain how that differs from a larger team?
Yeah, so I actually did have some input on that document that you're talking about. And, you know, part of this is COVID-based. With the idea that a type 3 team is about half the size of a type 1 team and it basically leaves behind some of the heavy collapse structure rescue in favor of mobility and smaller footprint and all that sort of stuff. So part of the plan would be that the teams would likely be smaller so that we can more socially distance ourselves. Be a bit more mobile, take up less space in the environment in general, or if we take up the same space, at least be further apart from each other. So trying to sort of balance the COVID environment with the need to be able to respond to disasters as we always have.
Why does it not surprise me that you had your hand in that? Jamie, you have a question.
Yeah, Joe, just a quick question for you. When you're talking about smaller teams, how does that affect operational effectiveness when you get into to a location?
Well, that's a great question, Jamie, and we spent a lot of time talking about that. You know, we use Type 3 teams pretty frequently, depending obviously on what it is that we're doing and where we're going. I think part of what we're trying to do here is simply balance our ability to respond and to be able to keep a team in the field in as protected a mode as we can due to the environmental challenges of COVID and still be able to perform as much of our function as we possibly can. So, you know, a type 3 team can go to a type 1 team fairly easy with the addition of some additional equipment and people. And we can always combine a couple of type 3 type teams together and enhance our capabilities as well. So it's really just designed to be a bit more flexible, a minimal diminution in the capabilities. And that lessening of capabilities tends to be stuff that we rarely ever need to utilize in a hurricane response anyway.
So there are specific roles, though, that, you know, that make up that type 3, correct?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, it's not a lot different from the quote-unquote the heavy team, the full team. Usually what the differences are in the numbers of people and in the capabilities on the heavy rescue major collapse structure side. That's usually where we tend to pull back a little bit in favor of mobility, wide area search, and lesser reinforced concrete structures, more toward wood structures like homes and that sort of stuff.
I'm curious real quick, Sam, is there any discussion on increasing the use of surveillance technologies to allow the team to have more coverage with less people? Now I'm thinking of our past episode where we've talked about drones and overflights and things like that to supplement. And I think that this might actually be an opportunity where that would work out well.
So that's a great question. We've definitely been encompassing and incorporating much more aggressive use of drones, whether that is in the air or on the ground or underwater. There's actually an amazing set of drones that move around on tracks and that sort of stuff. And can do pretty amazing things and get into pretty small areas. So those items really do help us to expand our capabilities and allow us to focus the more limited resources on areas that we really feel like we can make a difference in.
Well, this might be a question that none of us know the answer to, but the only hint we have is talking to Dr. Seth Hawkins about the wilderness. But if you're out there doing a search and rescue, is there anything in structures that would be a danger in terms of COVID? Does that make sense?
Most definitely. I mean, I think the thing we worry about is if there's a major impact via hurricane, tornado, earthquake, et cetera, on a place that is high risk for COVID. I think of places like nursing homes or places where a large number of people who are potentially a vulnerable population are close together, as well as hospitals being involved. So I think of Moore, Oklahoma, where the emergency department and the OB area were opened up via that tornado. And the idea that, patients there who might be COVID positive and sick, et cetera, and are in, heavy isolation conditions are now exposed to the environment, or those conditions are disrupted due to lack of power and storm damage, et cetera. So, part of what we might have to do would be to evacuate those people to a place of safety, et cetera. And so, it's not at all unlikely that we might be exposed to COVID positive patients and those who are pretty sick. I think back to Katrina, where we evacuated multiple hospitals, multiple ICUs, patients on ventilators and all kinds of stuff. We didn't really even think twice about the dramatic infectious disease exposure that we were probably putting ourselves in. But nowadays it's a bit more top of mind. So those are always issues that we have to think about.
Yes, absolutely. So, Becky, I'll throw this one at you. One of the things I was interested in was the local preparedness and response, and they had a response consideration checklist. And a couple of those things were for local governments to consider, like moving people. Have they awarded contracts for mass transportation, aligning their resources with other agencies within the area, reading the logistics of their particular area and issues they may have, and looking at how they can increase communications through social media so they can reach out to people that can't or shouldn't be physically somewhere? What do you think about those?
So I think the list is really comprehensive, but I think it's dependent on a lot of things that are not going to be equal across all the various communities that are going to be impacted. You know, every community's response is dependent on how prepared they are, on the type of money that's involved, on the relationships that are built ahead of time, on the ability to reach people by social media. I, as you all are aware, I love social media. I think it's a fantastic tool for communicating risk, but that to utilize it as heavily as they are, I think in this document assumes that everyone is on social media, and that's just not true. So I would think and hope that there are other ways to reach people. But this document, the thing that I think stuck out to me the most was how sort of focused on the virtual aspect of things. This document was, sorry, that was a weird sentence. And it makes sense that they're really focusing heavily on, you know, virtual EOCs and reaching people via social media. But I worry that that's going to leave some people behind and that we're not going to be able to reach everybody. So again, this comes back to sort of the tenets of emergency management. And that's really knowing and understanding the people that you serve and knowing the people in your community that have maybe some different and specialized needs, who are not going to be reachable via social media, who are going to need some extra care and protection when being evacuated, who may be a more vulnerable population and is going to need special treatment because of COVID. There's just so much to consider in any hurricane response. And when you add in a virus and the need for social distancing and protective gear, it just immensely complicates things. And this document is extremely thorough and frankly a bit daunting for any local emergency manager.
Yeah, I totally agree. And another thing that I hadn't thought about was when you need to evacuate people, now you got all these, you know, the evacuation route itself, these people can't find food because no restaurants are open. And what about gas? And everybody, you know, there's an open gas station, so everybody and their uncle are in there. You know, so much for social distancing. Those are things that I hadn't even considered. So another point they made was people wanting to evacuate that are not in the evacuation area. So they have that many more people on the road that don't need to be. These are all things that's like, wow. What do you think on those, Joe?
Well, I think that's all part of it. You know, it's just layers upon layers of complexity to some extent that require working through on many different levels.
Becky?
Yeah, so I was going to add to this. I think this sort of shows the importance, that it underscores the importance of an accurate forecast, because, I mean, you obviously never want to evacuate people who don't need to be evacuated, and that's always the goal. But I think it's especially paramount this year, because any type of excess evacuation is going to be extremely challenging, and we don't want to be doing it, obviously. So the accurate forecast is of utmost importance this year.
But I also would say along with the accurate forecast is making sure we're conveying the appropriate risk for whatever region. So we're ensuring that people don't evacuate unnecessarily, because that is something that happens every single year. People get panicked and they overwhelm the evacuation system. We've seen this many, many times. And so it's really important to ensure that not only is the information correctly, but that it's reaching the people in a way that they are able to understand and act on at the right time. And that's something that's difficult in a normal situation. So we'll see how things play out this year.
Jamie.
Well, and Becky, going along with that is, do we make a decision at the gubernatorial level for each state that maybe do they hold off pulling the trigger on making the evacuation order for an extra 12 hours or 24 hours so that they can wait and see if that forecast is a little tighter?
That's a good question. I don't know. This has sort of been in the back of my mind, is that I feel like so much of what happens in this hurricane season is going to come down to personal responsibility and how much each individual or each family unit understands their own risk and fully understands what they are prepared to do in any given scenario. And so maybe you don't wait for that hurricane order if you feel that you are at risk and you get out maybe 24 hours ahead of people. Maybe you stay a little bit longer because you feel confident in your ability to get to somewhere safe.
A lot of ifs, huh?
It's tough because I feel like so often we rely on the officials to make decisions, which is not the incorrect thing to do at all. But given the nature of the pandemic and how, you know, certain people may be at a higher risk or maybe have people in their family that are at a higher risk, I think decisions may need to be made a little bit sooner than maybe they're comfortable with, to ensure the safety of their family and to make sure they're protected.
Well, good points. Dan, how do people know they're getting the right weather information? I trust AccuWeather, first and foremost. But there's also all kinds of other news kind of trumped up to make it sound more terrible than it is. You know, networks that aren't weather specific. How do you deal with that kind of thing and make sure people get the right information?
Yeah, it's an interesting question and a debate that goes, you know, it goes on in the meteorology community itself too, on how to ensure people are getting information from the right sources. And I think the approach that sort of I take, and I know a lot of others take, is people will tend to gravitate towards the sources that over time provide them with the right information more often than not. And those people feel like they can trust that weather source over time. You know, that's not a perfect answer. Unfortunately, there's people out there, there's groups out there that provide inaccurate information or not, you know, they're not professionals or whatever it might be. And we hope that they don't have much of an audience. And I would say that, you know, people should go to the sources that are, you know, that have been around for a long period of time, that have a track record of accurate things, whether it be the National Hurricane Center, the National Weather Service, private companies like AccuWeather, the Weather Channel, your local television station. There's a lot of really great sources of information, and then extending that into not just weather, but also then your local authorities for what type of action to take because of that weather, I think is the way to go forward with it.
Well, and you're probably going to get a lot of the same information from those sources versus those that are just trying to hype something. So that should kind of be a clue that maybe you shouldn't be listening to them. Another thing that came up, people don't realize that CERT teams, the Citizen Emergency Response Teams, and the Medical Reserve Corps, which I've been involved in doing training for both of those are a large body of people that aren't generally disaster responders until they're needed to be. And that's usually when there's a massive amount of people that need to be taken care of. So the document addresses workforce protection for those. Joe, do you have any idea how that's going to work?
Ooh, well, that's a great question. You know, I think it was important that the document at least discuss those issues, because I think there is tremendous amounts of variability in those volunteer type entities. There's a lot of folks that are very experienced and comfortable in a more austere environment and have the time and are happy to, you know, get out there and do it. And there are others that feel like they need to make a contribution, but are very inexperienced and do not understand the environment and do not understand what might be asked of them. And so I think it's an effort to at least try to put out there the idea that all of those folks need some basic level of training. They need to understand how to work in that environment. They need to understand the risks that they put themselves and the folks that they're taking care of under. That entities that are asking for volunteers need to make certain that they are supplying a level of education and orientation for those folks that's enough to ensure that they can function safely and effectively in those environments.
Absolutely. And one last thought on this. Mass care and sheltering plans are astronomical as they are. And I didn't get to read into the document enough to see if they've fettered out some of these thoughts on how many people are going to be in a shelter. Do they have different accommodations for the elderly or the disabled, or, you know, how is that going to play out? Do you have some concept of that?
Are you talking to me on that one?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so, you know, again, I think that's part of the point of the, that part of the FEMA document is that those are indeed issues that are difficult, challenging, and often fraught with problems as well as inconsistencies. And so the part of the point of that document is to try to make a more consistent way that those kind of things are handled in accordance with current standards, expectations, public understanding, and governmental oversight, you know, related to what's happening with all those. The last thing anybody wants to do is be the guy on site of one of those kind of situations where it's all gone bad and the press is all hanging around and everything looks terrible. And, you know, you're the guy having the camera pointed at you when in reality, you're the guy there trying to help and make a difference. And unfortunately, you're made to look really bad in a situation that you had no control over. So it's really kind of focused on things like that. To try to help avoid those situations.
Absolutely. Becky, any final thoughts as we wind down here?
Just that I think it's really important to have already, at least at the very least, tested out your virtual EOC. There was recently a news article about a main EOC having to switch to virtual operations after several people were tested positive for COVID. And it's sort of, there's a bit of a sort of a shock amongst the emergency management community as to why they were not already doing a virtual EOC. And so it's just, it's interesting to, I know that like emergency management is such a hands-on thing. It's such a face-to-face, boots on the ground type of environment. That's how it's operated, you know, for as long as we can probably remember. But at this point, I think we have to have made sure that we have tested a virtual operations, that we can communicate with everybody that we need to communicate with, and to make sure that those, you know, there's backup communications, that, you know, you can get a hold of everybody that you need to. So that was just an interesting thing that in Maine, they, you know, recently had to just jump to that, to being virtual. So I test that before it's tested by the weather, I guess.
Yeah, and these are important people that have key roles. You certainly don't want to see them all in the hospital and unavailable. So that's another piece of it. Dan, any final thoughts from you?
Excited to be a part
of it.
Sorry,
we're muted.
Oh, I was muted there for a second. Becky had not. Becky was trying to shut me up. Apparently. No, just it's a pleasure to be on, and happy to be a part of a podcast that is interesting and. Meet the, or I guess virtually meet three other people here. So appreciate having me on tonight.
Well, we will have you back. You have a great voice for TV too.
Oh, well, that's my old radio coming out. I did radio
really?
At AccuWeather for about 3 years. I was on a whole bunch of different stations doing feeds as part of what I did at AccuWeather when I started. So, yep, it still comes out. You put a mic in front of me and, you know, that's what you get.
Yeah, you didn't sound very shy, so... We kind of picked that up about you. Dr. Joe, any final thoughts from you?
No, I think that's, you know, I'm glad we had a chance to talk about that document a little bit. It's a great resource out there. I think there's been a lot of time and thought put into that. I would encourage folks to go to the FEMA website or the Disaster Podcast website, where I'm sure you'll be able to find that document and read those lessons learned and best practices out of that.
I agree. Jamie, it's all you.
Yeah, it's been a great discussion, and I think that there'll be more discussions on this at the local level. I look forward to the conversation in our Facebook community as well, because I think this is going to be something that is going to evolve. This is a document that is great on paper how will it test out as our first couple of storms start striking and as it evolves and becomes a living document. And that'll be something interesting to follow up on maybe later in the fall. But I think that one of the things it comes down to is training and preparedness. And as Joe alluded to, the USAR teams, you know, have a planning structure that allows them to break down into smaller teams. They have that already set up in part of their training schedule. And so they understand how that works. So it's easier to adapt. And I think adaptation is a big part of training. It's one of the reasons the Paragon Medical Education Group is so sought after is because of their adaptability to specific needs for their clients. And Joe, I know this is something that's going to be coming up for years to come, how to adapt to strange things like pandemics in the midst of other disasters.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Jamie. It's actually been an interesting time with our work with the special operations for the military and how much COVID-19 is now a part of that world as well. But we appreciate the kudos there for sure. We look forward to talking to folks that would be interested in some customized training related to any of the things that we've talked about on here tonight. And they can always find us at ParagonMedicalGroup.com on the web and on Facebook. And they can always get us to the Disaster Podcast.
Great. And thank you all for your continued support. Help bring the podcast out to the folks that are listening to it every week. Becky, where can folks find you?
Well, I am always on Twitter at WX_Becks, BECKS, and always hanging around the Disaster Podcast Facebook page. And it's been some good discussions in there lately. I've been following, if not always engaging, but some really good stuff from our followers on there, as always.
And Dan, how about you?
You can find me on Twitter at WXDepot, without the T, DEPO. And I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but it seems like there's another potential for a third storm of the season, maybe in the second week of June in the Caribbean or Gulf of Mexico. So I think now is a time to be prepared and figure out what your plan is, because it certainly seems like we're getting geared up quickly here.
They're going to have to move back the date to May 1st if we don't have too many of these beforehand.
That's a discussion for another episode.
Yeah, definitely. Dan, thanks so much for coming on the show. And don't be a stranger. We'd love to have you back anytime.
Great. Appreciate it.
Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, under the usual social media places, Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, as with Becky, good stuff coming out of the group that's ever growing, and on the disasterpodcast.com website. What about you, Jamie?
Well, I can be found under the handle PodMedic in most of the social media locations, so please look me up, friend, follow, or otherwise catch up with me in those places. And, of course, in our Facebook group, which is growing, pushing on towards 800 people, I think, which is kind of exciting. I'm looking forward to when we cross that number and continue on, because this is a great opportunity for people involved in this line of work to really communicate and touch base with each other from a worldwide standpoint. It's very international in that Facebook group. So search us out, Disaster Podcast, in Facebook. Request to join the group. We often have our guests as members of the group as well, so that you can interact with them directly in the questions and comments following an episode post over there. So please do that. And Sam, I'll kind of kick it back to you. Great topic tonight. And I, like I said, I think this is something that's going to need to be revisited, because I am interested to see how this document survives contact with, you know, a major event.
Absolutely agree, Jamie. And again, we're going to hound you, so don't think you're going to get very far away. So we will see you again. But I think a good ending line for this show is COVID and hurricanes are not our everyday scenario.